As we continue our study of the book of Deuteronomy, tonight we're looking at Deuteronomy chapter 21. So I invite you to turn with me now to that chapter, Deuteronomy 21. Give your attention now to the Word of God. If in the land that the Lord your God is giving you to possess, someone is found slain, lying in the open country, and it is not known who killed him, then your elders and your judges shall come out, and they shall measure the distance to the surrounding cities. And the elders of the city that is nearest to the slain man shall take a heifer that has never been worked and that has not pulled in a yoke. And the elders of that city shall bring the heifer down to a valley with running water, which is neither plowed nor sown, and shall break the heifer's neck there in the valley. Then the priests, the sons of Levi, shall come forward, for the Lord your God has chosen them to minister to him and to bless in the name of the Lord. And by their word every dispute and every assault shall be settled. And all the elders of that city nearest to the slain man shall wash their hands over the heifer whose neck was broken in the valley. And they shall testify, "Our hands did not shed this blood, nor did our eyes see it shed. Accept atonement, O Lord, for your people Israel, whom you have redeemed. And do not set the guilt of innocent blood in the midst of your people Israel, so that their blood guilt be atoned for. So you shall purge the guilt of innocent blood from your midst when you do what is right in the sight of the Lord. When you go out to war against your enemies, and the Lord your God gives them into your hand, and you take them captive, and you see among the captives a beautiful woman, and you desire to take her to be your wife, and you bring her home to your house, she shall shave her head and pare her nails, and she shall take off the clothes in which she was captured, and shall remain in your house and lament her father and her mother a full month. After that, you may go in to her and be her husband, and she shall be your wife. But if you no longer delight in her, you shall let her go where she wants. But you shall not sell her for money, nor shall you treat her as a slave, since you have humiliated her. If a man has two wives, the one loved and the other unloved, and both the loved and the unloved have borne him children, and if the firstborn son belongs to the unloved, then on the day when he assigns his possessions as an inheritance to his sons, he may not treat the son of the loved as the firstborn in preference to the son of the unloved, who is the firstborn. But he shall acknowledge the firstborn, the son of the unloved, by giving him a double portion of all that he has. For he is the first fruits of his strength. The right of the firstborn is his. If a man has a stubborn and rebellious son who will not obey the voice of his father or the voice of his mother, and though they discipline him, will not listen to them, then his father and his mother shall take hold of him and bring him out to the elders of his city at the gate of the place where he lives. And they shall say to the elders of his city, "This our son is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey our voice. He is a glutton and a drunkard." Then all the men of the city shall stone him to death with stones. So you shall purge the evil from your midst. And all Israel shall hear and fear. And if a man has committed a crime punishable by death, and he is put to death, and you hang him on a tree, his body shall not remain all night on the tree, but you shall bury him the same day, for a hanged man is cursed by God. You shall not defile your land that the Lord your God is giving you for an inheritance. Thus far the reading of God's holy and inspired word. may he add his blessing to it this evening. Well, we've been noting throughout our study of this book that it was written in a particular context. It was written at the end of Israel's period of a 40-year period of wandering in the wilderness, and it was written to prepare them to enter into the promised land and take hold of their inheritance there. So Deuteronomy is a covenant renewal document. It's a document in which God exhorts his people to be faithful to the Sinai covenant once they settle in the land as their new home and their inheritance. Now, at the heart of the Sinai covenant is the Decalogue, or the Ten Commandments. And you may recall that the Decalogue, though it was originally written in Exodus chapter 20, it was republished in the book of Deuteronomy in a concise form back in chapter 5. Now, in chapters 12 through 26, what's going on is the Ten Commandments are being expounded and they're being applied to various situations that may arise once the people settle in the Promised Land. So God is showing them how to apply the law. There are obviously going to be other kinds of situations, but here's some case laws. Here's some examples of how to apply the law to specific situations. Now, the laws that are set forth here in chapter 21 relate to three of the Ten Commandments in particular, to the fifth commandment, honor your father and mother, to the sixth commandment, you shall not murder, and to the seventh commandment, you shall not commit adultery. But these teachings emphasize that God redeemed Israel from their slavery in Egypt so that they might dwell in his presence as his holy people. And we see this being emphasized in our text by the repeated references throughout this chapter to the necessity of purging evil from the land. They are to live in the land as God's holy people. Now, the first scenario that is envisioned in our chapter is that of an unsolved murder. Now, this is not talking about merely finding a dead body somewhere. That could be a matter of natural death, or it could be an accident. This is a situation in which there are clear signs of foul play, clear signs that indicate that the person was murdered. And, of course, that is a violation of the sixth commandment. And God declares, all the way back in the book of Genesis, that the fact that human beings are divine image bearers means that the crime of murder calls for the death penalty. So that was something that was true before the Sinai covenant was given. And that's why we understand it to be part of natural law, the idea of the death penalty as appropriate in cases of murder. Now, the focus here is on what should be done if there aren't any witnesses and if there isn't any kind of evidence that could implicate someone in the crime. What if there's no way to find out who committed the crime? Well, in our culture, you know, unsolved murders are designated, I believe, as cold cases, and they're set aside unless there's new evidence that comes to light in the future. But that wasn't an option in Old Testament Israel. You couldn't just set it aside and say, well, we can't do anything about it. We'll just have to wait for God on the last day to render certain and final and perfect justice. No, the fact that Israel was God's covenant nation, the fact that Israel was a holy theocracy, meant that such a murder incurred guilt for the whole land. It had to be dealt with. If the perpetrator couldn't be punished, then the demands of justice still had to be satisfied in some way, even if it's only in a symbolic way. Well, the instructions that are given here show how the Lord provided a way for atonement to be made in such a situation. And the first step is to determine what city is nearest to the place where the slain man was found. And once that was known, the leaders of that city are assigned the responsibility of dealing with the matter. And they're to do so by taking a heifer that's never been put to ordinary use, and therefore it's suitable to be set apart for this special purpose. And they are to break the neck of the animal in a valley that's never been put to agricultural use. Once again, something that indicates that this has been set apart for this specific purpose. Now, strictly speaking, this is not a sacrifice. This is a vicarious substitute for a judicial execution. A little bit different than the sacrifices that were performed on a regular basis in the temple. Although there's certainly parallels and similarities. But then after killing the animal, the elders of the city are required to take an oath. They are to declare their innocence in the matter, and they are to plead with the Lord to accept the animal's death as atonement for the guilt of the crime, the guilt that the crime has brought upon their land. And if they follow this procedure, Moses assures them, "So you shall purge the guilt of innocent blood from your midst." Now, as we think about this procedure that's set forth for this particular kind of circumstance, I think it's fairly easy to see how this points to Christ, how it prefigured Christ's vicarious death on the cross. In the scenario that's envisioned here in Deuteronomy 21, the innocent blood of the murder victim cries out for justice. Well, in the same way, the many sins that we commit cry out for justice. And that includes the sins that we commit in secret. It includes the sins that we may not even be aware of. Left to ourselves, we are defiled by our guilt, and we are consigned to the judgment of eternal damnation. But God graciously provided a way for our guilt to be removed and the demands of his justice to be satisfied. And he did so by sending his only beloved Son in our own flesh to die as our substitute on the cross. Well, that brings us then to the middle section of the chapter. And here in this section, the focus turns to laws dealing with various family matters that might arise after Israel settles in the land. And there's three particular scenarios that are set forth here. And the first concerns a scenario where a man decides to marry a woman who had been taken captive in war. Now, if you recall last week's sermon, when we looked at Deuteronomy 20, there's a distinction between how Israel was to conduct warfare with those who lived inside the land of Canaan and how they were to conduct warfare with those who were outside of the land of Canaan. This would obviously be a war that was fought outside of Canaan, a war that was fought far away, because wars fought within Canaan called for the complete annihilation of the enemy people. Now, as we read this, this idea of marrying female captives, from our cultural standpoint, the notion of marrying women taken captive in war probably seems pretty barbaric, doesn't it? It sounds like caveman types of stuff, right? Well, there are a couple of things I think that we need to take into consideration as we think about this, though. First of all, we do need to remember that Israel was a very unique nation. Because of Israel's theocratic status, any nation that Israel fought in a divinely sanctioned war was setting itself against God's kingdom. And so the fact that God allowed any people from an enemy nation to survive after a war with Israel, that was a great mercy. And then second, we should note that what is described here was actually quite out of the ordinary in that time. Women taken captive in war were typically made into slaves. Now, the possibility of such women being given the status of a wife and being given the protections afforded by marriage was quite unusual. And then a third factor is the fact that such a woman was to be given time to mourn the loss of her people. Well, that was a mark of compassion. And it was also a symbol of God's grace. It expressed, you notice that her head has to be shaved and even her fingernails have to be trimmed. This seems to be expressing the idea of purification and sanctification and her being transferred into a new people. She was turning away from her old life, which would have been an idolatrous life, of course, and she's preparing for a new life among God's covenant people. And this is what made it possible for an Israelite to marry her. He's not marrying her as a pagan. He's marrying her as someone who has now been incorporated into the covenant people. And that, of course, is the extension of God's grace to her. And now, you'll notice that there is provision for sending her away, which we would understand to be a situation of divorce. I'm not going to really talk about that today. We're going to wait to talk about that until chapter 24 because divorce is dealt with in a little bit more detail there. Now, the next example relating to family life has to do with the situation where a man has children from multiple wives. Now, this teaching would certainly apply to instances involving a second marriage after the death of a first wife, but it was probably also meant to deal with problems that might arise in polygamous marriages. I think we have to acknowledge that. Now, of course, the Bible makes it clear from the very beginning that the creational norm for marriage is monogamy. You know, right from the get-go, that's made clear with the creation of Adam and Eve. And yet, polygamy was practiced in the ancient world. We see it being practiced even early in the book of Genesis with Lamech. And it was tolerated in Israel for a time. It was tolerated. It was not promoted. And actually, there is not really any good evidence that it was very widespread among the Israelites. The evidence in the books of Samuel and Kings indicates that it was primarily the monarchs who had multiple wives, and that it wouldn't have been as typical for ordinary people to do this. And then the other thing we should note about this is that of all the biblical instances of polygamy, can you think of any of them that commend this practice to you, that make it something that seems like it's a good idea? I think it's the exact opposite. All of the examples that we see in the Bible show that this is a situation that is just fraught with problems. And that's because it goes against God's creational norm. And actually, it's one such problem that is envisioned by the law that is set forth here in Deuteronomy 21. God understands that it's very possible if a man has more than one wife, he might love one more than the other. And God makes it clear, and of course that we know that that happened with Jacob's marriages, his marriage to Leah and his marriage to Rachel. We know that Rachel was the one he really loved. He was tricked into taking Leah the first time. But the Lord made it clear that that did not give the man the right to transfer the rights of the firstborn to a son who was not the firstborn, a son that he favored because he was the son born through the wife that he loved. So yeah, really this is a law that upholds justice and the natural order of things. And then there's a third law pertaining to family life in this chapter, and this has to do with a disobedient son. And we could certainly say, you know, this would include daughters as well. I presume they would be included here. Now, I don't know if any parents have ever read this to their children, you know, as a warning, you know, to make sure that they stay in line. But when you read this in context, I think it's very clear that this is not talking about the normal disobedience that has to be addressed through the loving exercise of parental discipline. This is very clearly an instance of protracted defiance. And the mention of gluttony and drunkenness call attention to the fact that the son is probably a grown man, or at least an adolescent at this point. And it calls attention to the fact that his character is marked by excessive and insatiable greed and a lack of self-control. He's just intractable. Despite his parents' repeated efforts to restrain him, he refuses to listen to them. And of course, that is a blatant and unrepentant transgression of the fifth commandment. And this is not something that could be overlooked in Israel. Remember, Israel is a theocracy. Israel is God's holy nation. And parental authority had been ordained by God to represent his divine authority. And so this was something that had to be taken very seriously. Now, as we think about this, you know, we can also, you know, apply this to society in general. Parental authority is very important for society. It's the cornerstone of all human government and societal order. You know, we can see in our own society the cultural devastation that results when parental authority is undermined or neglected or defied. You know, there are segments of our population where that happens at an alarming level. And the effects are not good for those segments of the population. Now, if that's true in our society, you know, if the defiance and undermining of parental authority is so destructive for society, well, how much more would that have been the case in theocratic Israel? And that is why, that explains why such an evil had to be dealt with very severely. We might think, wow, this is something else. This is very severe to deal with this with the death penalty. But we have to remember, in that context, this was the form of discipline that was necessary to protect the covenant community from sinful influences and from the wrath of God. Well, then that brings us to the last part of the chapter, verses 22 and 23. And here we see how instances of capital punishment could sometimes include the idea of, or the practice of, exposing a corpse by hanging the body. So this is not really talking about hanging as a mode of execution. We don't really have any strong evidence from the Old Testament that it was a mode of execution in Israel, but rather it's something that was done after the person had been put to death. So in some situations, it might be determined that the corpse of an executed person, perhaps they've been executed through stoning, should not be immediately buried, but should be left to scavengers, should be exposed to the elements for a certain period of time. And God puts limits on how long that could take place. But the reason why this would be done is to vividly portray the consequences of breaking God's law. This would have visibly embodied the curse of God on lawbreakers. Really, it's the same sort of thing that's depicted in the vision that the Apostle John describes in Revelation 19, where the defeated enemies of God on the last day are offered to the birds of the air as the great supper of God. It's a very interesting chapter because earlier in the chapter, you have reference to the marriage supper of the Lamb, to those who are invited by God's grace and are brought into the marriage supper of the Lamb. Well, in the second part of the chapter, we see that if you're not part of that supper, you're a part of another supper that's a gruesome supper, the great supper of God, where the enemies of God are offered to scavenger birds. So God's curse is his divine wrath against all who transgress the righteous requirements of his law. If we fail to uphold the law of God in any way, even in the smallest detail, then we are under the curse of the law. Sin makes us the objects of the wrath and curse of God. And in our fallen estate, every single one of us is under God's curse, because there is not one of us who can claim to have fully met the righteous requirements of God's law. Now, you may know that the Apostle Paul cites this passage from Deuteronomy in his letter to the Galatians, and he does so to explain what Christ accomplished for his people when he died on the cross, when he was hung on a tree. by submitting himself to that terrible fate, Jesus took upon himself the curse that would otherwise be directed at us. And so this is the doctrine of penal substitution. And Jesus was our substitute on the cross. He endured the penalty that was against us as lawbreakers. He bore the curse on our behalf. And that helps us to understand the words that our Lord quoted from Psalm 22 as he hung dying on the cross. He quoted those opening words from Psalm 22, my God, why have you forsaken me? Those words express the fact that Jesus was not only rejected by men, he was rejected and cursed by God because God had imputed our sin to him so that he could be our substitute. And being made a curse was far worse than the terrible physical suffering that he experienced as he died on the cross. But because he endured that curse, if we trust in him for our salvation, there is no curse left for us. And we are set free from our defilement. Well, as we think about, you know, that overall theme in this chapter, that God's people need to make sure that as they live in the land, that they're not defiling the land. This idea of not being defiled is something I think that we can apply to our culture today. I doubt there are very many people in our culture who would want to be seen as defiled or corrupt or guilty. Even though biblical Christianity is increasingly marginalized in our culture, people still exhibit a great deal of interest, and even irreligious people, even atheists, they still have great interest in showing that they are virtuous, that they are upright. And we're seeing one particular expression of that in the whole wokeness movement. Wokeness is about signaling that you're a righteous person. And of course, the problem with wokeness is that it is a man-made righteousness. It can't make up for the guilt that our sin incurs for us with God. Wokeness and political correctness and virtue signaling, these are the sorts of things that the Apostle Paul is confronting in Romans 10 when he says of the Jews who rejected Christ, for being ignorant of the righteousness of God and seeking to establish their own, they did not submit to God's righteousness. We can't establish our own righteousness. The only way we can be righteous in the sight of God is to submit to God's righteousness and to his provision for how we can be righteous, how we can be counted righteous in his sight. In other words, the only way we can be rid of our defilement is to look to the cross of Christ in faith and say, he loved me and gave himself for me. He took my place. He bore my curse. He bought me with his own most precious blood. Amen.